I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With a satirical and musical eye to past presidential campaigns, Northern Sky Theater in Fish Creek, Wisconsin is presenting And If Elected. It runs September 29 through October 16. And Jeff Herbst is the artistic director, director, and performer in the show. He's with us this hour to reminisce about... oh, all kinds of people. Andrew Jackson, Adlai Stevenson, A. Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, Grover Cleveland, James Blaine, William Henry Harrison, Martin Van Buren, Teddy Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, JFK, Richard Nixon, and many others. He has been with Northern Sky since 1991 and has worked on over 50 original productions, including Guys on Ice, Lumberjacks in Love, Packer Fans from Outer Space, and Bone Dance, and he has performed on and off Broadway and in regional theaters throughout the country. He has a lifelong passion for politics and for presidential trivia, and thus the show that we're going to be talking about. And welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at @KDunnShow. Jeff, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kathleen. Nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you. And what a great way to become informed about history. This is the way to do it. They say we're massively uninformed. We don't know our history. But it's always good to learn your history through a little song, huh?
I think it is, yeah. A little song, a little humor. It gives a little perspective, I think, historically.
And some of these, I'm really glad you did this, because there are all these presidents I don't know a whole lot about. You know, they tend to be a little prior to Abraham Lincoln, and some of them after Abraham Lincoln. I think our knowledge of those presidents is not great. And so you informed me about a lot of those people, and I thank you for it.
Oh, did you learn something?
Yes, I did. That's a good thing, isn't it, to learn something? So you've been doing these shows, what, every 4 years, every presidential thing since 92?
Yeah, since 1992. Well, Dave Peterson first created the show back in the 70s, and he did it with the Heritage Ensemble, which was the predecessor of Northern Sky Theater. And he had a group of college students who did it in the park, and then it sort of sat around for a little while. They did toured around the Wisconsin school system a little bit as well. And then Fred Alley, who was one of the co-creators of Northern Sky, had it in mind to do a show in 92, our first fall show ever at Northern Sky Theater. And he thought it would be fun to bring this show back. And he and I grew up, we were grade school buddies and graduated high school together, so he knew my personal passion for all things presidential trivia-wise, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought it would be really fun to augment the show a little bit and have me put in my own personal touch. And so that's the show that I first performed in 92. And since then, of course, we've had, you know, 24 years of presidential elections and lots of things going on. And we just kind of, every 4 years, we revisit it and we get reminded about how a lot of things are exactly the same, and that is always sort of reassuring.
Right. And that all things presidential bug that you got came from where?
Well, I don't know exactly. I think it's, you know, I think it's like a lot of kids. They sort of glom onto something, but I think for me it was when I was about 10 years old and I was in fourth grade. And I had all kinds of interests. You know, I was a busy little boy, like lots of boys of that age. But I do remember that I came home from school, and I was obsessed with watching Batman reruns. And I was a good Catholic school boy, and I was told in no uncertain terms that I would have to give up something for Lent. And I was told that it had to be something important, and the only thing that I thought was the most important thing in my life at that point was watching Batman reruns. So of course, I had to give them up, but then I didn't have anything to do when I got home from school. So I decided I found a book on presidents, and I started to get obsessed with it. And you know, it grew and grew and grew as a little boy, anyway. And that became sort of my passion du jour, was to continue to, you know, study all things trivial about the president.
And you gave up Batman?
You know, I don't know that I ever went back to it.
Hmm.
I I don't even know if it was on anymore after the 40 days of Lent, but I'm sure it was. But, it was a kicking off point for me to at least start to delve into all of these things that I became semi-obsessed about, and now I'm doing shows about, so it bode well, I guess.
Yeah, it paid off, that's for sure. Well, let's delve right in, and we have to start, because it's my show, for heaven's sake, with Abraham Lincoln, of course.
Well,
my favorite guy, and I'm so glad he's included, but also some of the quips that you include from what Lincoln had to say about Douglas and Douglas about Lincoln, not very kind things, but very, very funny things. I don't know where you found all of these, but let's start with Lincoln. And then I think there's a song, Emancipation, too, which you can guide us into.
Well, Lincoln, of course, was the most one of the most famous presidents for using unbelievable wit. I mean, the man, he knew how to undercut instead of slam from the top. And I think that's why he was so brilliant. When he was running against Douglas in 1860, they had their famous debates, and of course we're all, you know, with bated breath holding on for tonight.
Yes.
But in that particular debate in 1860, of course, these candidates, you know, they were standing out in an open forum, and they were declaiming, you know, to the crowds. There was no amplification, obviously, and so, you know, they had to make their points, and they had to be salient, and it was Douglas who decided to kind of take the low road in one of the debates, and he said that Mr. Lincoln has tried everything, and he's always been a failure. He tried farming, and he failed at that. He tried flatboating, and he failed at that. He tried school teaching, and he failed at that. And he sold liquor over the counter and failed at that, and now he has entered politics and is doomed to make it the worst failure of all. And Lincoln just sat there and sort of chuckled to himself while Douglas was saying this, and then at length he rose to reply, and he said, "I'm very much obliged to Judge Douglas for the very accurate history of my life that he has taken the trouble to compile. It's all true, every word of it. I have worked on a farm, I have split rails, I have run flatboats, I've taught school, and yes, I did run a store, and on occasion sold whiskey over the counter. Now, I remember in those days, Judge Douglas was one of my best customers. Many a time did I stand on one side of the counter and sell whiskey to Judge Douglas on the other side. Now, the difference between me and the judge here is that I have since left my side of the counter." I mean, it's a zinger.
Wonderful.
You know?
It's just wonderful.
Isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, we could only hope that we could have rhetoric like that in a debate these days,
I
right?
know.
Yeah.
Everybody writes zingers for the person who's up there, and you know when it happens. You know there are going to be tons of them tonight, that somebody, Roger Ailes or whoever, I'm sure Hillary has a zinger writer as well, that somebody will have written that, and they just hope it gets picked up the next day. Oh, there's the line, right?
Yeah.
So what's the song? What's the Emancipation song? This was for what campaign?
This was in 1864.
Okay.
This was the re-election of Lincoln. And at that point, I mean, the Civil War was still raging during the campaign before Lincoln was elected. And the opponent for Lincoln in that particular election was McClellan. And McClellan kicked off his campaign at that point by saying that Mr. Lincoln is nothing more than a well-meaning baboon. He's the original gorilla. And we could imagine if a candidate said something like that today, they would be, instantaneously disqualified, obviously. But things flew fairly rampantly back then. Even during that election, his Gettysburg Address, which every school child practically knows now, it's still one of the things that's studied as great rhetoric, as a great speech, was panned by the Chicago Times. The writer said, "The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterance of the man who has to be pointed out to intelligent foreigners as President of the United States." I mean, it's just remarkable to us now, because you can look at any historical rankings of the presidents, and whether it comes from somebody who leans Democratic or Republican or is right down the middle, the consensus is that Abraham Lincoln is the greatest president the nation has ever seen. So it's really remarkable to think back on what happens, you know, contemporaneously to these elections, and how how distorted the opinion can be at the moment that you're in it.
And here's a song from that 1864 campaign.
Oh, the train emancipation rides majestic through the nation, bearing on its cause a story, liberty, a nation's glory. Roll it along, roll it along, roll it along throughout the nation, freedom, strain, emancipation.
Oh, someone's had strong objections, right and wrong in all directions. Lawyers, editors, physicians, doctors, priests, and politicians.
Roll it along throughout the nation, freedom, strain, emancipation.
See the people run to meet us at the depot, thousands greet us. All take seats with exultation on the train, emancipation.
Roll it along throughout the nation, freedom, strain. Emancipation.
From the show, And If Elected, which opens again September 29, runs through October 16 at Northern Sky Theater, Fish Creek, Wisconsin. And what a perfect show to see as we get very close to the presidential election of this year. We're welcoming phone calls for our guests, too. So here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The artistic director, who's also the director and a performer in this show, Jeff Herbst, is with us. He's been with the Northern Sky since 1991, and he's a presidential trivia and, you know, substantial history expert because he gave up Batman during Lent back when he was in fourth grade. What a story. Let's go to Lyle in Green Bay, our first caller for you. Hi, Lyle.
Hi, Kathleen. It's so good to talk to you and Jeff. I called because I was in this show in 1980.
Oh, yay!
With Dave Peterson, he took us up to Door County. We rehearsed for like a week, and then we all spread out to state parks all across the state and did this all summer.
That's fantastic. I love that.
Dave was awesome. And I had two questions for you. You may have just answered one with that recording. You've kept some of the original songs, I'm guessing?
That's another thing that I think it's important for people to know who are interested in the show is that all of the songs and the jokes and anecdotes, by and large, I mean 99% of them, they're all authentic. They're all things that have, you know, that we've collected. And, of course, that was Dave's passion when he started the Heritage Ensemble, was to make sure that all of this great material, all this extant folk material and all these great songs, that they had a venue and that they continued to stay alive and that people had exposure to them. And that was one of Dave's arrangements, the one that we just sang there. And he was.
I remember it. And Mama, right. Where's My Paw, possibly?
Right, Mama, Where's My Paw, That particular song is all about Grover Cleveland and James G. Blaine, which was, at that time, and maybe still, dubbed the dirtiest campaign in United States history, where Grover Cleveland was accused of having sired a child out of wedlock, which he admitted he had done. So he actually had an illegitimate child when he ascended to the presidency, and, of course, his Republican opponents just made great sport of that particular part of Cleveland's background.
Oh, yes. My second question is Doug Manchesky joining you for this show?
No, Doug is in our other fall show, Guys and Does, which is running at the same time, so there's an overlap. But he's at the Door Community Auditorium. I know a lot of people know Doug from Guys on Ice, and he's...
Well, yeah, I went to school with him. We did some shows with him a long time.
Oh, did you really? At Green Bay?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, Doug is a longtime performer with us. Now he's been with us since 1997. And he certainly is iconic as Marvin in Guys on Ice, but also spectacular as Staghart in Guys and Does.
Awesome. Well, if anybody is hearing this, see this show. It's wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the call. Well, that was kind of fun. Talked to somebody who was there some years ago.
Yeah.
Let's go to Mary in La Crosse next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I said I don't get around much, but I did see Guys on Ice on public TV,
So
I'm wondering if this is going to be produced on public TV for us all to see.
Well, if you get enough people together with petitions, I'm sure Wisconsin Public Television would come up here and film just about anything we do. I think it's actually a fairly, like for us, it's a fairly expensive proposition because of union issues and whatnot, but this particular show would be a little difficult for them to fill. It's in a historic town hall in Fish Creek. I don't even know if they'd have enough wattage to run all of their equipment. I love doing the show there. It's the first place that we performed it in 1992. Again, it's a historic old town hall, and back in the day, it was built in 1880, and there were political rallies and political speeches that were made from the very stage that we're doing the show from. So it feels very authentic, which I love.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for the call. We do have part of that clip of Mama, Where's My Pa. Was this the Grover Cleveland election where he ran against James Blaine?
That's correct. Yes.
And I think that we just had John Dickerson on a couple weeks ago who described James Blaine, and who in the world even knows who he is now?
Right,
I didn't
right.
remember him. The most interesting person who never was president.
Perhaps, yeah, yeah. Well, he, you know, that was the election where Blaine was accused of financial irresponsibilities, but being a real model husband and father, and Cleveland was accused of being a, you know, a less than honorable father, but a really, really honest politician. And it's interesting that with those particular topics, which we have seen surface since then, as we all know.
Yes, we have.
It was not a problem for the voters at all that Cleveland had this illegitimate child, and they elected him to the White House. And he served as a really good president. He also, interestingly, and most people do know this, but he's the reason why we have 44 presidents and not 43. We have 43 men who have ascended to the presidency, but Grover Cleveland was elected to two non-consecutive terms. So he is the 22nd and 24th president of the United States.
Isn't that interesting that he didn't lose because he had an illegitimate child?
Right. I know. Can you imagine?
Yeah, really. In 1884? Really?
Exactly. Exactly. I don't know if though. Who knows, you know, to what extent all of this information was out, but I mean, the newspapers were carrying it in the day. There was a song written about it, for heaven's sake, called "Ma, Ma, Where's My Pa," where, you know, his Republican opponents were—I mean, they were doing everything they could to broadcast this news. So I can't imagine that the electorate at large wouldn't have had a fair inkling, if not have been clobbered over the head by this information. But they didn't think that it rose to the level of disqualifying him because he was so honorable as a politician. He was so straightforward. He was such a good guy in office that just wasn't an issue for them.
Here's part of that song, and we'll welcome more phone calls. We're talking about campaigns, presidential campaigns that go way back, and they're all the subject of a lovely show. I've seen a tape of the show. I haven't been up to Fish Creek, although that would be a fun thing to do. And if elected, the show has been performed every election year, presidential election year since 92. Songs, authentic songs from the presidential campaigns that go way, way back. Jokes and dialogue and facts. So it's a terrific way to celebrate the election during this pre-election time of 2016. Here's the Mama, Where's My Pa song, which is authentic, and we'll welcome more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number on the Ideas Network.
Little Tom Tin was a troublesome kid, a cute little cuss, I declare, with eyes full of fun and a nose that begun way up in the roots of his hair. Jolly and fat was this frolicsome brat as he played through the livelong day. But one day, to his cost, his papa got lost, and he and his ma sang a lay.
Oh, mama, where is my pa?
He's up in the White House, darling, making the laws, working the cause, up in the White House, dear.
But, mama, I want my pa.
He's up in the White House, darling, making the laws, working the cause, up in the White House.
Dear.
Let's go to more phone calls. Ron in La Crosse is next. Hey, Ron.
Yeah, talking about campaign slogans, one they don't hear about, and I don't think it appeared on any campaign political button, but during the 50s, you know, Adlai Stevenson ran against Eisenhower, 52 and 56, and there was a sort of a slogan, and supposedly, nominally, it was in support of Stevenson, but I think the Republicans came up with it. It was kind of tongue-in-cheek. Well, Eisenhower campaign went on by the slogan, "I like Ike." Adlai Stevenson, there was a slogan, and it was simply, "I'm madly for Adlai." And I think it probably has come up with the Republicans, because it kind of, Adlai Stevenson was trying to work for detente with the Soviet Union, and a lot of people thought, well, he was kind of weak and naive, you know, sort of a peacenik and egghead, and when that campaign slogan, sort of an anti-slogan, Go Madly for Adley, it seemed to be sort of a siren song that Stevenson was singing, and that it would have been better to stick with Eisenhower because he was more down-to-earth, you know?
Interesting, yeah. Well, Adley Stevenson, of course, yeah, he also was a man of great wit.
Yes.
You know, there was a time when he was told that he was twice, as you mentioned, a Democratic nominee, and he was told by an admirer one time that he would have the support of all thinking voters, and Stevenson replied, that's not enough. I need a majority. Which is, you know, again, pretty darn clever, I think. On another occasion, Stevenson was out campaigning, and he was asked to address a crowd of farmers from the only available elevated stage, and a manure spreader. And Stevenson, who was a Democrat, said, this is the first time I've spoken from a Republican platform.
Yeah, I love those that have just really keen wit. Those,
right?
Yeah. Those are the best.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ron, very much for your call. All right, let's go back a little bit more. We don't have songs from him, but the quotes, you obviously have done research on what people said about the presidency. John Quincy Adams, who I think is a remarkably interesting president, actually we have a book about him that we're going to have on in a couple months, or maybe a month after the election. Was it he who called the presidency the four most miserable years he'd ever had?
John Quincy Adams, yeah, the four most miserable years that he'd ever had.
Wow.
And that's a man who, after he was president, went on then to serve in the House of Representatives, which is something we can't even contemplate a president doing these days. But I think he liked the legislative process better. I don't think he was much of an executive. It wasn't where his strengths lie. But interestingly, too, even then, John Quincy Adams, he was a very intelligent president, and he's known for his writing. Of course, he defended the slaves in the Amistad trials.
Mm-hmm.
But even he, while he was campaigning against Jackson in 1828, the rhetoric was, Jackson is a liar, a thief, and a drunken bigamist. So, you know, the language, we all are shocked, we think, by some of the stuff that goes on these days. And it is more like that now in this election cycle than it has been. But if you just rewind the tape, you start to see that there has always been a little bit of hyperbole and rhetoric that's flown, and a lot of times it's for effect. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's not to say that it's not appalling, but it is historical.
Mm. Lee sends this email. Maybe the reason that Grover Cleveland won re-election, even while there was so much talk of his illegitimate child, was because it was before women had the right to vote.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Really, really good point. It's one that I hadn't really ever even thought about. And, of course, women didn't have the right to vote until 1920. The first woman who asked for the right to vote, and I'm going to have to go to my notes here, maybe you have something, Kathleen, yourself, was Margaret Brent, who way back in, I think it was 1647, even before we were a country, she had petitioned the Maryland House of Burgesses demanding the right to vote. She didn't get that right, and it wasn't until, 1920 that women were given the right to vote, and now it's 369 years Margaret Brent made that plea to the Maryland House of Burgesses that Hillary Clinton has become, the head candidate of a major political party with a real chance at winning the White House. I remember when we did this show back in 1992, the thing that we had to say about this was that Geraldine Ferraro, of course, had been on as a vice presidential candidate. And then we kept waiting. You know, every 4 years we'd be looking at one another going, well, what are we going to say now? Who's even in the race? And even 4 years ago, all we could say was, well, early on, Michelle Bachmann was in the Republican race, but she was gone before anybody knew she was in it.
Right.
You know, and so it really has been kind of remarkable in that sense. We do touch on a couple of things in the show about that issue, and one of the songs of the day that was used to deny women the vote was a song called Oh, Dear, What Can the Matter Be? Dear, what can the matter be? Women are wanting the vote. But we also have a lovely song on the show called Bread and Roses, which kind of harkens back to Julia Ward Howe, who said, "We who have long stood for the political equality of the sexes may now say to our opponents, friends, behold the dawn. The brighter day is already here. In the vast domain of human conscience, God has again spoken the words, let there be light." Of course, that was all about suffrage.
Yeah, and we have part of that song, Bread and Roses.
As we come marching, marching, we bring the brighter days, the rising of the women means the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler, tend that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glory.
We're talking about this show, and if elected, which will be at the Northern Sky Theater in Fish Creek, Wisconsin, September 29 through October 16, what better way than to remember, and they are historically accurate songs and sayings and dialogue from presidential campaigns through American history. We're talking about that this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number. Jeff Herbst is our guest, and he is artistic director, director, and performer with the theater, and started his collaboration with them in 1991. Some of you may remember certain campaigns or songs, maybe more recent ones because they were during your lifetime, or some of you may be a presidential historian, as Jeff does this on the side, does a lot on the side and has for a long time. And you may want to talk about those campaigns that you remember. 800-486-8655 is our number. Have you, Jeff, included or written a song, because I don't exactly know what you'd say, about this presidential campaign?
Well, it's one of the things that we constantly try to figure out is, as things keep rolling and things get more historical in terms of campaign songs, the trouble you run into is that the last campaign songs that were written specifically for presidential candidates were back in 1976 for Gerald Ford and for Jimmy Carter. And we hadn't, until this year, even included those two songs because I was never sure that they would hold up, because of their earnestness and their sincerity. You know, when you have things like, "I'm feeling good about America," and "I'm feeling good about me," "I'm feeling good about Gerald Ford," you know, I mean, it's just, you know, there is no level of irony whatsoever in that. But what's so interesting to me is people say, well, you know, what happened since then? Well, radio and television have taken over, and now the internet, of course, has surpassed that by leaps and bounds in terms of how people get their information and how the candidates' views are dispelled, and so there's just a whole different world, and I don't think any of us could hardly imagine that somebody trying to write something that would be a positive message for a candidate wouldn't be immediately skewered. Even before it was written, practically by Saturday Night Live or whomever, that you just can't get away with it anymore. And what the campaigns have done instead is they use popular songs of the day, and a lot of times they use them without permission. And it's then up to the artist or up to the, you know, the candidate himself as to whether or not they wanted to get in any kind of dispute with an artist if they don't want that song to be used. Donald Trump, for instance, I think has been told by at least 9 artists now to stop using their material, and that includes artists like Adele and the Rolling Stones and the widow of Luciano Pavarotti, and most of the times they do stop using those songs. Bill Clinton used "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow." He still uses it, I think, when he goes on stage. People associate that song with him. Fleetwood Mac, who wrote that song, never gave him permission to use the song. Now it happens that I think most of their members vote, politically on his side. So I don't think they raised any kind of a ruckus. But he didn't have permission to use that song from them.
I don't know. Maybe this has happened with others. You would think that, given the prominence and the number of times that a song would be played, people would be itching. Composers and famous groups or solo artists would be itching to be able to compose something, you know, kind of fun or meaningful or whatever for a presidential candidate.
Do you think people would take it? I mean, do you think that they could get away with it? I think the other part of the problem is that once you play a thing like that, I think it either catches and it works for you.
Right.
If it doesn't, then it backfires in a big way. And I think candidates these days, they're just so risk averse in that regard. You know, because they're scrutinized so closely, and if they try to make their mark with an original song about themselves, you know, that's a leap.
Yeah.
That's a leap.
Well, as long as we're being a bit nostalgic, let's be nostalgic about James Garfield.
Yeah, you know, the book that you mentioned, I read that book, and
I loved that book.
With it.
Oh, me too. Me too. I did loved it.
Did you see the an enactment of that thing on PBS? Did you see there was a
documentary? No.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, it was a little odd. It was kind of stilted because there was all kinds of it was sort of like a Ken Burns documentary, except there were real actors playing some of the parts, including James Garfield. But that story is so fascinating, and of course, James Garfield is such a fascinating figure historically. He was very young. He was at that time, he was the youngest president who had been elected. I think he was maybe 43.
Was he really?
Yeah, he was extraordinarily young. And he really didn't have the presidency at all in mind as part of his political trajectory. He was drafted. And back in the day when these campaigns happened, this was a lot of elbow, jostling that was going on in the back rooms of these campaigns at the time. And political candidates could emerge in a convention. And there was a lot of talk about this particular go-around, you know, with Donald Trump and whether or not the Republicans were going to get any nominee who would get to the number needed, the number of delegates needed in order to secure the nomination. As it turns out, Trump did get there. But, you know, this brokered convention idea where you'd go in and there would be nobody who would get the requisite number of votes on the first round, and then it could be a free-for-all, which is what I think a lot of people were hoping for because of the theatrics, and it just doesn't happen anymore these days. But that's in fact what the norm was during most of these campaigns, and that's why Garfield got into the presidency. And unfortunately, of course, Garfield was assassinated. He was shot, and in modern medicine, he did not have a life-threatening wound. What ended up happening was, at that time, antiseptic in surgery was not... was not regarded as necessary. There were proponents of it who were saying, you have got to clean your instruments before you go in. Or, you know, but there were... Garfield's personal doctor who was brought in was not a believer in that particular method of the day. And so Garfield ended up getting severe blood poisoning while he lay in his bed for weeks on end with a nation at vigil, wondering whether or not their president was going to survive this gunshot wound. And in fact, he didn't. He expired from blood poisoning.
And he could have been, she has said, Millard has said, and when you read about him, you think he really could have been a wonderful president and so needed to have lived during that time.
I think that's probably right. It's difficult to know when a president has only had 1 year in office, you know, what their legacy could have been. But there's no question that James Garfield was highly regarded. He was a man of real reason and a good temperament. He also was incredibly intelligent. You know, he was a He was a university dean, president, I think, of a university. And he has the distinction, another one of my trivia things, where he could write Latin with one hand and Greek with the other at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot about
that. How
somebody
practices a parlor trick like that, I don't know. But, yeah, he apparently, maybe it wasn't even a trick for him. He was probably just, you know, that brilliant.
So how did Harry Truman win? Did he have a song?
Well, Harry Truman used I'm Just Wild About Harry, which was, you know, fantastic. And there's a famous portrait of Lauren Bacall perched on a piano singing that song to Harry Truman. We have that song on the show, too. Well, Truman was, you know, he was indefatigable as a campaigner. He really got out on the stump, and he made, you know, he made hundreds and hundreds of speeches. And even though his opponent in 1948 was Thomas Dewey, and Dewey was a smart man too. He had a really ruthless political machine. He was out and really on the attack, and it was the do-nothing Congress of Harry Truman, and all of the polls of the day, every single one of them had Dewey ahead, some of them predicting that it would be a landslide. And of course, everybody knows about the Chicago Tribune headline that trumpeted Dewey defeats Truman, you know, that came out the next morning. And of course, it was erroneous. Truman, in fact, had won.
Hmm.
And it's interesting, too, you know, Truman took over from FDR, and I think it was one of those moments in United States history when you have, again, you know, FDR, the only president to ever have served more than two terms. And it was only after he was elected to his fourth term, after that, that the Constitution was changed to make term limits for presidents to be only two terms, so you can only serve 8 years. He was into his fourth term at this point, FDR. So he was, you know, clearly a man beloved and a man who had brought us through the Great Depression and the Second World War. So when Harry Truman ascended to the presidency because of FDR's death, I think a lot of people were worried. But Truman stuck with it, and Truman worked hard, and Truman was a really thoughtful man as well. And now, with a little historical perspective, Truman is right up there ranked historically as a great president.
And certainly FDR, one of the most significant presidents in history, certainly of the 20th century, the most significant, wouldn't you say?
No question. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the raft of problems that he you know, waded into were unparalleled probably since Lincoln had to deal with the Civil War. So his, you know, his tireless effort on behalf of, you know, the electorate, I think, is something that everybody recognizes as being really above and beyond the call of duty. For, you know, this is a man, too, who everybody, you know, we all had this big brouhaha about Hillary Clinton doesn't say that she has, you know, pneumonia. But here's a man who a lot of people didn't even know that he was wheelchair-bound and had polio. You know, and this, he was in pain most of the time that he was in that office. And that's kind of remarkable.
And who was it who did? Was it William Henry Harrison who died of pneumonia after giving this 2.5-hour inaugural address?
Yeah, good old William Henry Harrison.
Good old William Henry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He does have that distinction. Yeah, William Henry Harrison, that was the election of 1840 when he ran against Martin Van Buren. And William Henry Harrison was—he was a war hero, and he was chosen because he was a war hero, and mostly he was chosen because he had no political views. And there was a committee that was actually formed to keep him from developing any, because people thought that he would be more hindrance to himself if he started spouting off any kind of ideology.
Yeah.
And the other thing about him was—it was interesting. That's considered sort of the first modern campaign, 1840, and that was when they first started having real campaign rallies, and there were torchlight parades, and there—that's the first time you had real songs and gimmicks and all these slogans. So when Harrison had been one of the heroes of the Battle of Tippecanoe, and so when John Tyler was chosen as running mate, the battle cry became Tippecanoe and Tyler too, and it sort of stuck, and that's one of the songs in the show as well.
Hmm.
It was a really kind of a great campaign song. I think it's one of the most memorable melodically. You know, it sort of sticks with you. But Harrison, 2.5 hours he had to stand out in the rain. He didn't wear an overcoat, and he literally caught pneumonia and died after only a month in office. Of course, Andrew Jackson said it was a deed of kind and overruling providence.
We're talking about past presidential campaigns. Northern Sky Theater in Fish Creek, Wisconsin is presenting, and they have done this every presidential election year since 1992. The show is And If Elected, and it's running September 29 to October 16. Jeff Herbst is our guest this hour, artistic director, director and performer. He has been with the company for a number of years and has been in the shows And If Elected since 1992. So we're hearing some of the songs that are a part of this gala and hearing a great deal about presidential history because Jeff has been studying that for a long time as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can reach us via email too, and that is talk@WPR.org. And we love your comments on Facebook, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Everybody's voting for Jack, 'cause he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track,
'cause he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. 1960 is the year for his high hopes. Come on and vote for Kennedy.
Come on and click with Dick, the one that none can lick. He's the man to lead the USA. In Dick we have the one who truly gets things done every time he has his say. He's a man of peace and reason for the job in every season. And he knows how to fight when he is in the right. So let's all click with Dick.
That was Dick Nixon? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's quite a song.
I mean, can't you just hear that song? I mean, it could be just done as is as a parody. You know what I mean? You don't even have to change the word.
No, you don't. Was that on television? Do you know, Jeff? Or it was a radio thing, or what?
It was definitely used in television ads, you know, back in the day. And that was the 1960 election. When Kennedy used High Hopes, which you played before that. Nixon's was an original song. Kennedy's was, of course, a song that had already existed.
Yeah.
And, Frank Sinatra made into a huge hit with a big band arrangement for Kennedy. The Nixon thing, it's so fascinating to me. He turns out to be sort of, you know, the president that kind of changed everything for me in a weird way, because when I was 10, he was president in 1973, and at that time, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I had collected all of this stuff. I had made all these homemade flashcards, and I made all these handmade electoral maps so I could study the outcomes of all these elections.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah.
Jeff, wow.
And sort of understand, you know, what had happened. And even today I hear all these people talking about, you know, how close the election is nationally. Like, it doesn't matter. All that matters are the swing states. You got to keep looking at the swing states, because it's all going to come down to electoral votes. Like in 2000, when we all sat and watched Tim Russert, you know, with his old-fashioned chalkboard, going, it's all down to Florida, folks.
Right.
These electoral votes, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I had these electoral maps, and I would read anything that I possibly could, and there was one book that I just loved from the Madison Public Library. I used to go in with my dad, who worked down West Mifflin from there, and I would march up West Mifflin past all that college housing to the Madison Public Library, and I'd go right to the historical stacks, and I'd pull out all these books on the presidents, and there was one book called The Book of Presidents, and I loved it. And I hated having to turn it back in, so I put it on my Christmas wish list that year, and I got it. And then I took all of those things that year, too, for my 10th birthday. I got this waste paper basket from my grandmother that had all of the presidents on.
Oh, Jeff.
I mean, now I think, you know, somebody really had a sense of humor putting all the presidents on a waste paper basket. But at any rate, the one in the middle was Richard Nixon. His picture was bigger than anybody else's because he was at the time. So I took all this stuff with me to my elementary school in fourth grade, and I did a show-and-tell presentation for the class, and then I left all of my stuff on the back table. And when I got, at the end of the day, I went to collect everything, and I noticed that the Book of Presidents was missing.
Oh, no.
And I asked my teacher, Ruby Myers, if she had seen it, and she said no. And then I asked the janitor if he had maybe thrown it away by accident when he was cleaning up, and he said no. And so I asked all the other teachers.
Oh.
And the book had been stolen. Somebody had actually stolen it. This was a really small little elementary school, so it was kind of inconceivable. Even now when I think back, and I'm like, well, how the devil did that happen?
Right, right.
At any rate, it was gone, and I put all of my stuff away, and I got a little disillusioned at that point. And then the next thing that happens is it's Watergate. And, you know, I'm looking at everything that's going on, and like millions of other households, ours was planted in front of the television watching
yes.
the President of the United States resign the office. And I was so naive, of course, I started to clap because our household, you know, was not Republican. But I was clapping, and my mother just leaned over, and she just gently said to me, "We might not like the man, but this is a very sad day for our country."
Hmm.
And that, you know, that's always stuck with me. And every time we do this show, I think, you know, what is it about that office? What is it about America that wants us to continue to believe and hope?
Mm-hmm.
And we place a lot of our trust in that one person because of the way our founding fathers set up this nation. You know, the executive branch has equal stature with the legislature, which is, you know, 400 times more populated than that executive branch is, and even the judicial branch, which has got, you know, 9 members of the Supreme Court. But it's just this one person that we put all of this sort of hope in and all this trust in. And I always think, you know, if I could start living my life backwards right now, that the moment I would anticipate the most would be getting that book back again.
Oh, and you never replaced it?
I never could find that book again.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, you know, I mean, here, I'm not that devastated by it.
I am.
I mean, you know, but what I am is I'm ever hopeful because of it, you know? And
right.
I think that's the thing that all of us want and wish for is, you know, this idea that it does take courage for somebody to say, I'm going to take on that responsibility, and all we can do is sort of keep hoping that people who have a passion and integrity and really want to do the job well will step forward, and that will recognize their attributes and will embrace them, and will try and push all the other, you know, all the other nonsense yeah. out of the way, if at all possible.
Mm. Park is calling in from La Crosse. Hi, Park.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, I'm enjoying the show. And I just wanted to make a comment about the persistence of some of these really good slogans. I grew up near Lafayette, Indiana, which is, of course, the site of the Tippecanoe Battlefield.
Right.
And there was the big mall was the Tippecanoe Mall, and right across the street was a little two-bay car wash that was called the Tyler II Car Wash.
So. I love that. That's great. Things do hang on, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do. So.
In pretty Thanks. Unlikely places. Thanks, Park, very much for your call.
Harrison was the first governor of the Indiana Territory.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let's go to Deborah in Michigan. Hi, Deborah. Deborah, are you there? Oh, Deborah's not there. Well, we don't have much time anyhow, so let me just ask about the show, when it opens, where it is, for people who haven't been there, Jeff.
Yeah, well, Fast and Furious, we open this Thursday.
Oh, Thursday. Okay.
Yeah, and we run Thursday through Mondays for the next 3 weeks, but we do close October 16th, which is Sunday.
Okay.
You can find everything you need to know at northernskytheater.com, great little website that's got all kinds of information. And we are in Fish Creek at the Gibraltar Town Hall, a lovely old renovated hall. Again, that's it was built in 1880, and it seats about 125, so get
nice.
Your tickets early. This show, you know, back in the day when it first started in 1992, Fred Alley, Karen Mall, who is back this year doing it with me, Fred unfortunately died in 2001, but the three of us would hawk pamphlets outside on the streets of Fish Creek trying to get people to come see the show. And since then, it's 1996 and onward, we've almost always sold out the run. So.
Good. Well, people need to go to the website. The show is September 29th through October 16. Jeff Herbst, our guest, and we thank him so much for a really lovely, fun hour. And hope you have a chance to see the show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and to KP for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until mañana at 1 o'clock.